All right, here we go. Good morning, Rich. How you doing? Good, good, good. Microphone in place. Instrument ready. our little drops and music beds ready. Good, good. I've got my script ready. This show is very scripted, as you know. All right, my friend, and let's do episode number 455. 455. We love a podcast. We love numbers that end in 0 and 5, so I guess this is an important one. 445, not 455. 445. 445. 445. Which means we have 55 left, right? As I said, which will get us to probably early January of next year for the big 500. Anyway, all right. No, wait a minute. Wait, no. You're supposed to be telling me this stuff. No, we're at 455, right? What's your book say? Hello? Yeah, 455. Yeah. Well, we're getting closer here. What do we do? Come on. Reggie, you got to help me here, my friend. Jeez. 455. We only have 45 left. Yeah. Okay. Come on. Don't cheat me on those 10. That was 10. Those were 10 hours, if not more, of podcast brilliance, my friend. Come on. Don't shortchange those last 10. 455. Five. Hey, you know, I mean, my mind gets scrambled a little, but you know, you got the official book. Every week I say, put it in the book. What's your book say? 455. All right, here we go. Oh, I'm getting a little feisty today. Good, good, good. That's good. Let's keep that energy going. Let's go. Star, smile, strong. 3, 2, 1. What's wrong? Oh, okay. You're not ready. Okay. I was all psyched up. Whoa. Okay. All right. Boy, thank God no one hears any of this. All right. You ready, Reg? Good. 455. Put it in the book. Star, smile, strong. 3, 2, 1. Hey. No, I don't like that. Ready? 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNRadio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. Of course, listening is important to this podcast. It's our lifeblood, but it's also right up there. Close second, 1A, if you will, is getting out there and telling your friends, spreading the word. Tell anybody who listens to a podcast that you know, family, friends, colleagues, whoever it may be, strangers, let them know that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and it should be theirs too. Your loyalty and devotion, always, always. So appreciated. And of course, if you like what you've been hearing since May of 2016, or maybe you've only been listening for the last 2 or 3 weeks, however long you've been listening, you need to get up to speed as to where we've been so you know where we're going, or you just need some time to fill and you've already listened to this week's, go back and listen to some past ones. Always interesting stuff. It's the podcast version of a good rerun. Go to WGNRadio.com, go to the podcast section, hit the prompt for this podcast, and there you are. There's no limit. You should be scrolling and loading forever. There's enough there. Like this one is there now, too. Number 455. 455. So I thought this week would be a good idea to talk about a movie that I've seen recently, But that also has some bigger ramifications, and I'm happy to say. And also is a lead into the big night. You know, the Super Bowl, you know, for some reason, I don't know what the rules are. Sometimes you can say the big game, or you can't say Super Bowl. You have to say the big game. I think in conversation, we can say the Super Bowl, right? I mean, the big game, you know, but there, I don't know if there's copyrights. I don't know what's going on. Anyway, you know that big game? Well, this is the big night. The big game is the Super Bowl in football, and the big night in entertainment, especially in movies, is obviously the Academy Awards, and the big night is coming up. We've already finished the big game. That one's done, but we need the big night. And so the big night is March 2nd in California, in L.A., of course, the home of Hollywood, the home of movies. And it's going to be an interesting Oscar ceremony this year. There's no question about that. Although the wildfires seem to have been tamed and contained, if you will, there is a lasting imprint of those fires that started pretty much on my birthday this year. They started the day before, but they seemed to do the most destruction, especially for Pacific Palisades and Altadena, on my birthday. So that's a nice way to remember January 8th. Instead of, Elvis Presley and David Bowie and Stephen Hawking and Elton Jim, now January 8th. I mean, the official day may be January 7th, because that's when they started and began to cause some damage. But it was on my birthday when they really took hold and started to just go out of control. I remember my birthday just a month or so ago. That was the way I kind of spent my birthday, watching the destruction. It was just so intense and so sad. But so clearly, L.A., the city, physically, as well as L.A., the city, emotionally, collectively, humanly, behaviorally, is still struggling and grieving and coming to terms with the aftermath of those fires that have completely destroyed some towns in California near LA, and certainly have affected everyone in that region. The destruction, the loss of life, the loss of property, the loss of mementos, keepsakes and memories, and the loss of home. You know, you really can't underestimate, you know, our home, physically and figuratively, is so important. And when you lose that, just from a reality standpoint, where do you stay? But from an emotional standpoint, where do you live? How do you live? So L.A. is going to be going through a lot of change and grief and transformation. It can't help but because of the aftermath of those fires. And there's no question that is already that sentiment is finding its way into many of the award shows. We just recently had the Grammy Awards, and the entire show, while certainly going forward with the pomp and circumstance and outrageousness of an entertainment award show, in this case music-based, there was a definite tribute and a definite cognizant effort to make people aware of and help in the aftermath of, you know, emotionally as well as realistically of moving forward, LA strong, And so they've done concerts out there. There was one recently called Fire Aid that was similar to, you know, kind of Live Aid and things like that. And so L.A. Is going to be going through a lot of transformation, as I said, in grieving over the next several years. This is not just something that's going to be solved in any kind of short term, but especially the emotional impact, especially for people that have lost their home, some that have lived there for decades. But I don't care if you live there for decades or for months. It's your home. And so there's a big question. Conan O'Brien will be hosting the Academy Awards this year, and I saw some comments by him and the writers of the show are already trying to figure out that balance between the celebratory mood of what the Oscars Academy Awards are all about, giving awards, recognizing excellence, glitz and glamour, which is Hollywood. This is the biggest entertainment-based award show, or you can argue any kind of entertainment-based show annually in the world. And yet, as I said, many of the people in that room, the actors, the crew members, people in that industry, it's a huge, those people were directly affected. It's not just empathy for others. In many cases, the people in that room, many of the actors and people in the business, in the movie business, were directly affected, who lost their homes, or certainly were in the fear of it, which is still something to handle and try to get through, to understand how lucky you were and why were you spared. There's a lot of psychological things that go on, so I know that there's a lot of attention being paid to how do we strike that balance between a very serious, emotional event that has rocked the industry as well as the area, regular, you know, not just in the industry, but citizens of all kinds. And at the same time, how do we still bring some of the excitement and anticipation that revolves around the Academy Awards? So that's not going to be easy. From what I've heard Conan O'Brien say, they've got some ideas of how to handle things, but even though the show is not that far away, March 2nd, they don't want to, at this point, really etch anything in stone because they want to make sure that they are reflecting the mood of the moment, which is no easy task, because how can you predict what things are going to be like in LA in 3 weeks from now or so, you know? But that's kind of the goal. But there's no question that as March 2nd approaches, there will be some excitement and prognostication, who's going to win. And so some of that will be there, but I think there will be certainly a somber mood hanging above that. But at the same time, I think there will be some excitement as well. I think what these award shows need to do, in many cases, is provide an escape. You know, don't forget, for the last month and a half, by this time it'll be almost 2 months since the fires, early March, the people that it has affected, both directly or just, I mean, if anybody who lives in the Southern California area has been affected or knows somebody who has, or knows somebody themselves or someone else who almost did, or probably at least, at the very least, evacuated. And so it has touched anyone that lives in the Southern California area one way or the other. And so but at the same time, you know, you can look at it that the award show can also, you know, be a source of escapism, that you're not disrespecting those who are in the midst of grief and suffering and uncertainty in their lives because of the aftermath of the fires. You're not disrespecting them by creating an event that for at least a couple hours, 3 hours or so, provides a little escape from the harsh realities. And that's the balance that you have to play. You know, I think there needs to be a recognition of the reality of what has happened and the mood of what still will pervade the area in Southern California for, as I said, many years. But there's also a need to escape from that. It was a horrific event in itself, the ravaging and the destruction and the power of these fires. That alone was horrific, and then the damage that it did and then what lay in its wake and the loss. As I said, you know, yeah, houses can be rebuilt, but memories and keepsakes, those can't be. Yeah, you could build a new house, you can buy a new car, you can get a new couch, but you know, can you replace that photo that brings memories, or that keepsake that was handed down through your family, things like that? So it'll be interesting to see how they handle that. But one thing I have to say, I recently saw a film that that I'm excited to know, and I saw it just a few weeks ago. So after the awards were given out, the nominations were given out, but I'm happy to say that not only did this film impress me, but it really exceeded my expectations. And I'm glad for that, because I'm a big fan of the subject of the film. And the movie I'm talking about is called A Complete Unknown, which is a biography pic, a biopic, not a biopic. It drives me crazy. It's biopic. It's biography picture, biopic. Yes, if they put it into one word, it looks like biopic, but that makes no sense. The word was created by taking two words and shortening them. Biography picture, biopic, not biopic. Even if it's put together in one word, it certainly needs a hyphen. I've been through this. I still hear people say biopic. Drives me crazy. Biopic about one of popular music's and entertainment's, I believe, will be all-time legends, Bob Dylan, The Complete Unknown, which stars Timothy Chalamet in the lead role, Edward Norton, some newcomers like Monica Barbero, Elle Fanning. There was a lot of controversy when this film was first announced, and then when the casting was made. There have been other attempts at Bob Dylan-oriented films that have had varying degrees of success. Haven't really been successful. They've been critically acclaimed. They've been applauded for their adventurous take on him, but they haven't really been bona fide hits. And even Bob Dylan himself has been in films, and he actually wrote one himself called Masked and Anonymous, which many feel may be the worst movie ever made. Look it up, Masked and Anonymous. You'll see that's right up there with Plan 9 from Outer Space. And Bob Dylan is deliberately a very difficult... you can't really blame the filmmakers, because Bob Dylan has deliberately created a persona or personas of mystery from day one. He has always created a backstory and an image that you can never be sure is true. You never really know what is going on. He truly is an artist in that sense, is that he completely immersed himself from a young age, from a 20-year-old. He completely immersed himself in an alternate reality, steeped in an artistic life. I was talking a few weeks ago about David Lynch, very much the same way. These are, you know, very, very brave and bold people, because taking a creative or artistic route in life is a huge, huge risk. Having a creative spark in you, having some kind of a talent in you, like that creativity, that artistic viewpoint, it's not something learned. I really believe it's something inherent, and it is so overwhelming within you. But there it is such a precarious route to follow in life, because even, you know, unless you win the lottery in the entertainment world, living an artistic life or a creative life, you know, fame and fortune is fleeting. Longevity is really not, and stability is not even in the job description. And yet people are driven to it, because I believe there's just something inherent. And if it is in there, it's hard to ignore it or push it down. And those who completely succumb to it, they put it all on the line. Bob Dylan was 20 years old, and he hitchhiked from the outskirts, the rural areas of Minnesota, to come to New York. You know, in the early 60s, in 1960, 61, and so without knowing anyone, that was, you know, I mean, I can imagine what his parents said. What the hell is going on here? That was a brave, brave move, and many people have done that. They go all in, and sadly, many of them that go all in do not find that kind of fame and do not find that kind of to support themselves. And it's a hard life. And even with fame and fortune, it becomes a hard life. But those that do find the acceptance and can live an artistic life, as I said, the way that David Lynch had described it, that's a rarity. But, you know, and you say, oh, my gosh, look at how rich they are. But, man, they took a huge risk in their lives. They could have easily have been, you know, complete failures. And what would they be doing? So they took a huge gamble. And in the case of Bob Dylan, young guy, no connections, no anything, not a Nepo baby in any sense of the word. But he felt he had a talent, and clearly he did. And he put it out there, and thankfully for him as well, there's a lot of luck involved, which you cannot you cannot predict. But he was able to put himself in front of people that that were also talented, who could help him, who could open doors for him and nurture him and mentor him. And that is pure luck as well. Yeah, you got to have the talent, but talent alone and drive and ambition does not do it. There's got to be a total just perfect storm. And it does happen to people. You got to put yourself out there, as I said, and that's what Bob Dylan did. He took a tremendous risk, but there's no guarantees. And so that's really what the film is about. It's the early years of Bob Dylan. We see him arrive in New York, and we go up to about 1965 is when so we're following kind of his beginnings as a folk star, and then being ordained the voice of a generation in the early 60s with his folk music and his protest songs and his songs about humanity and people, that which the country, of course, at that time, as I said before, talk about perfect storm. He arrived and he either was he had a keen barometer as to what was happening and tapped into it, or he helped move it. It's hard to tell. It was really a melding of the two, which took him literally out of obscurity within a couple of years. A lot of people don't know that Bob Dylan was at the March on Washington. You know, you see pictures of different people at the March in Washington. Bob Dylan played at the March in Washington, the Martin Luther King event, which changed civil rights in this country. Bob Dylan was there, young guy. He has been a huge, huge influence and creative force at this point for more than 65 years almost. That's really saying something. And yet he's very mysterious on purpose. As I said, he has deliberately created a persona. He's deliberately been someone who has never played by any rules. He's deliberately pushed envelopes and angered fans on purpose to put forth his creative vision, his creative philosophy. He's put it out there, and he's either challenged you to enjoy it or understand it or not. But Bob Dylan has never been boring, that's for sure. And so what this film really does is it does a good job of tapping into that. And I have to say, there was a lot of controversy when the film was first announced, as I said, because A, there have been several Bob Dylan movies about his life that have been attempted over the years. There was a recent one called I'm Not There, which had like four or five different people portraying Bob Dylan at different points in his career, even females. Because, as I said, the view is that there is no one Bob Dylan. And he has taken on many personas and many characters and many presentations as an artist and his music. It's been protest and folk music. It's been rock. It's been Christian gospel. I mean, Bob Dylan was born Jewish, Robert Zimmerman, but he had a religious conversion to some extent, or if not a conversion, at least he was influenced by Christianity and wrote several albums that reflected that. He's recorded Christmas albums and crooner songs from the 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s. Country albums, rock albums, you name it. He has done it, and he's done it on his own terms. And so trying to encapsulate that kind of artistry, and he's the only songwriter who have ever won the Nobel Prize for Literature. So it's not just, oh, well, yeah, okay, there's a certain people that like Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan whether you like his music or not, or whether you're aware of it, which sadly I hope that more people will open their ears to it. We are in the midst of at a time when there is literally a legend plying his work. And oftentimes we don't fully appreciate that. I wonder at the time, yes, there's no question that people like Michelangelo and Leonardo da Vinci were praised and lauded at the time, but I don't know if they really were to the extent that they are lauded today, the way they are viewed as once in a life, not even once in a lifetime, once in the lifetime of humanity, a kind of talent. Now, Bob Dylan, of course, you know, there's a lot of controversy about Bob Dylan because, you know, he's not the best singer. And that's not what it's all about. It is about his songs. And mainly, Bob Dylan is a poet. He really is. That's what he is. That's why he won the Nobel Prize for Literature. He is a poet. You know, there's a lot of controversy about Bob Dylan, even within the music world. And if you know anything about him, you'll know that a lot of his best songs, the ones he's known for, like Blowin' in the Wind and other things like that, a lot of times the music is based on and almost copied by, you know, old songs that were, you know, centuries old. But it was his lyrics. It was the words. The tunes are very simple, especially those early folk songs. And most folk songs are based on tradition and what came before. So it wasn't like Bob Dylan was copying or doing something that wasn't part of the folklore tradition or the folk music tradition. But it was the words, Blowing in the Wind, Times They Are A-Changing, Masters of War, Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, It Ain't Me, Babe, Positively 4th Street, some of these songs that were... And of course, Like a Rolling Stone, which transformed the culture. They literally did. But it was the sentiments and the lyrics and the message and the writing and the craft of the writing. And granted, Bob Dylan's voice is not the best. And Bob Dylan is the one that made it cool to say, it's what I'm saying, not how I'm saying it. That was the revolution of Bob Dylan. Up to that point, there were singers and there were songwriters. The songwriters sang the songs because they couldn't sing. And the singers with the beautiful melodic voices couldn't write songs. Bob Dylan certainly wasn't the first singer-songwriter by any means, and he was influenced by many of the early so-called singer-songwriters of America's past, like Woody Guthrie and Leadbelly and Pete Seeger and many others. But there was what Bob Dylan brought to the mainstream was that it's the message, not the medium. And not the vessel. And many times, some of Bob Dylan's biggest hits, if you will, were not recorded by him. They were recorded by others who had initially that had more pleasing mainstream kind of voices. You know, Blown in the Wind was recorded by Peter, Paul, and Mary, the folk trio. Very harmonious. Mr. Tambourine Man, huge hit for the Byrds. Very harmonious. All Along the Watchtower. by Jimi Hendrix, a defining version of a song by Bob Dylan. Quinn the Eskimo. These are all Bob Dylan songs. But even in a more recent time, one of my favorite songs of all time is Make You Feel My Love by Bob Dylan. Came out in the late 90s, and Garth Brooks has recorded a version, and Billy Joel has recorded a version. There's some songs that you may not know that are some of your favorite songs that were written by Bob Dylan. And so when this film came out, it was smart in its scope to focus on that period between 1960 and 1965 when Bob Dylan really was changing music, helping to change the world, and also changing himself. And that's what I think this movie does very well. It shows how Dylan himself changed and how he forced the culture to change. And what was ironic is that he forced the counterculture to change from itself. That's a layer that you don't think about very much. You had the counterculture happening within this time that was rebelling against the establishment. And then what Bob Dylan did, he was a counterculture hero, and then he rebelled against the counterculture. And he got them mad just as the counterculture had gotten the establishment mad. And even though it's not historically correct, it is there is some artistic liberties taken. But, we see where Bob Dylan is this folk hero, and Pete Seeger, a dyed-in-the-wool folk aficionado and ambassador, who at the time and throughout his whole life never abandoned his his beliefs and his philosophies of folk music and music helping to change the injustices of the world. All those who are consider themselves progressive or in far left and warriors of social justice in today's world, which certainly has a huge influence. I hope when you watch this film, if you watch this movie, you realize that Pete Seeger was a pioneer for you. And he was the real deal. He went to jail. He didn't sell out. He remained true to his beliefs and his integrity. He didn't sell out for fame. He didn't abandon the cause. He lived for the cause until he died. People may not remember, but Pete Seeger played at Barack Obama's inauguration when he was well into his 90s, at least late 80s, I would assume. Still fighting and working toward social justice, equality, and things like that. So for Pete Seeger to see an African-American elected president after what he saw in his lifetime, the kind of segregation and racism that existed in the 30s and 40s and 50s in his lifetime, and certainly 60s, to have lived long enough to see an African-American elected president, it had to have been an amazing personal event and somewhat victory for him. So this film does a really good job of taking many of these different transformational moments and putting them into this story. And it's not as if they're forcing them. Bob Dylan was a change agent. And as I said, you know, Bob Dylan takes a lot of criticism from the average person. Oh, I can't understand what he's saying in his concerts. He purposely, once again, this is Bob Dylan being Bob Dylan. This is Bob Dylan. You don't have to necessarily like it, but you have to appreciate why he's doing it. You know, for more than 25 or 30 years now, he's been almost never stopped touring, and he plays his various songs with completely different arrangements, changing them up. He never wants those songs to become wallpaper. Now, much to the chagrin of people that are big fans, who, you know, we want to hear those songs the way we remember them. And I'm part of that. But then when I look at him as an artist, I have to say, as much as it's frustrating as an audience, I do have to appreciate the guts it takes. And what's interesting is that Bob Dylan continues to sell out and draw people. And even at the time when they're there, they may get a little frustrated because they don't, but they're there. The man is a legend. And there's sometimes when you have to give people of that kind of creativity and bravery and experimentation, you have to just give them the benefit of the doubt. As I said, David Lynch, perfect example. You know, there's sometimes when you watch a David Lynch movie, as I was talking about before, and you just shake your head when you're done going, I don't know what the heck I just saw. I was intrigued by it. And maybe there are some times when I was like, I don't get this thing at all. But I have to at least admire and appreciate the vision of it. Where is this coming from? It's as if there is a creativity and a vision that is so unique and so different that you just have to say, you know, I don't know what the heck he's doing, but the fact that he could bring that to life, you have to give him credit. And that's the way Dylan is today. And that's the way he's always been. As I said, you know, they make reference to it in the film where he's telling some of his early girlfriends that he was in a carnival, that he was in a traveling carnival before he got to New York, and he met these people and he learned this stuff, and none of that was true. He was creating, well, I mean, as he was Bob Dylan. I mean, that's not his real name. He created a new persona right from the beginning. And so if you're going to create a new persona, if you change your name, which, what can be more identifying of who we are than our name? So if you're going to change your name, I guess in Bob Dylan's view, even at age 19 or 20, his view was, well, if I could change my name for some reason, then I'm changing my identity. And if I'm changing my identity, well, then why should I stop at just my name? Why can't I change my entire backstory? Why can't I change my entire origin? I mean, your name is what you get, literally, for the most part, on your first day, if not first minutes, of life. It is your first identifying aspect of your life. You are forever tied to that. It's a huge moment. I don't even think we realize how important and how defining being given a name is. But it's transformational in our lives. We are forever, we had no choice in it, and yet we are forever defined by it. And many times we actually live into that name. And our background perhaps supports that. Well, Bob Dylan, as an artist, said, I'm not Robert Zimmerman. I'm Bob Dylan. And, Yes, Robert Zimmerman was born in Hibbing, Minnesota, and he went to this high school, and he did this and he did that, and he's got parents and he's got a whole thing. But Bob Dylan, who I have now invented, I gave Bob Dylan a name. And Bob Dylan is not from Minnesota. And Bob Dylan does not have those parents. And Bob Dylan was not working in a grocery store or whatever he did when he went and did not go to that high school. Robert Zimmerman did, but Bob Dylan didn't. And so from an artistic standpoint, Bob Dylan felt, I would assume, if I can create a persona of Bob Dylan, then I can create who he is from scratch. It's a clean slate. And so when he started out, he would tell people he was trying to create this mysterious background, this background that you couldn't define, even at that age. This is my point about having an artistic vision and being bold enough and brave enough to fully lean into it, to fully live it. This wasn't just, oh, I'm going to change my name because I don't like the way it sounds. Bob Dylan changed his name to change himself, to create almost a new person, a rejection. Bob Dylan, you know, if you think about it, when I'm talking about the counterculture at that time, rebelling against the establishment, Bob Dylan was the personification of that. Right? If you think about it, he was rebelling against his establishment, his personal establishment. His personal establishment was he was a part of the Zimmerman family from Minnesota. Just as this is the way we do things in the United States, and these are the rules, and this is the way our culture is. Well, in the late 50s and early 60s, the counterculture said, no, we don't think the way this is going is the right way. We want to change it. And that was the birth of the civil rights movement. That was the birth of, as I said, the counterculture. That was the birth of certainly the mass acceptance of rock and roll. It was a revolution. And in a small way, personally, Bob Dylan's life and career mirrored the same thing that was going on. He was breaking with the establishment, personally. His own establishment, being his family, right? If you think about our lives, our family is our establishment, right? We have traditions in our family, right? Your tradition, your family does this on a certain holiday, or your family does this every summer. Every family has their own traditions, their own views of what is right and what is wrong, of what we do. And for the most part, the people in the family follow those traditions. Just as American culture developed from the beginning of this country with rules and behaviors, a certain tradition began to evolve. And for the most part, the majority of people followed those rules or traditions that were happening. And what was so revolutionary about the late 50s and then the early, especially in the 60s, was that a huge portion of the culture, of the population, decided that this was not the way things should be. You know, we started, this country started as a revolutionary agitant. But we were united in our revolt as a country. We were united, thus the name United States. We were united in our revolt against being ruled by England. So while we were adjutants, we were a united adjutant. And from getting our freedom, for the most part, we remained a united adjutant until, of course, the Civil War. About 100 years after our freedom. A huge break in the thinking of the way our culture was developing and our country was developing and the way the masses saw the right and wrong. We had the Civil War. And after that was settled, at least the war part, you know, to the victor goes the spoils. And while there was a so-called victory, there never was since the Civil War began and since it ended, and maybe even from the beginnings of our founding fathers, some of the schisms in this country, especially around race and class, but mostly race, have never really been satisfied, even in our Constitution. The Constitution was basically a document of compromise. Bold ideas, yes, but compromise as well, because there was already two very different views in terms of racial equality and slavery, obviously. But so we had in 1860s, we had this great division. And then 100 years later again, we have another huge revolution, societal revolution, about what's happened over the last 100 years and what has become termed and deemed normal. And a huge part of the population decides once again that the way things are not the right way. And thus, the counterculture. And as I said, so what Bob Dylan represents is the personification of that same revolt that was happening en masse in the country. He did it on a personal level. He was rebelling against his own establishment. In this case, his family, his background, his upbringing, his traditions. He changed his name. He moved away. He created an entire new backstory and new persona. And he's continued to do that. And if you've never really listened closely to Bob Dylan's music, or if you've never really thought about him, I hope you'd start to think of him in that way. Now, look, I'm not going to sit here and say that I was a Bob Dylan fan since I was a little kid, because I haven't. In fact, I came to Bob Dylan in the early 80s, long after he had been a phenomenon. I was in my 20s when I really discovered and got into Bob Dylan and understood it and started to understand and listen to his back catalog and understand things. But I was a little kid, during the 70s. I remember hearing the name, but to me that was an old name anyway, or it was a name I didn't understand. I couldn't, as a little kid or a young kid, I couldn't totally grasp what was the whole counterculture at that time. I had to go back and learn about it and understand it. It wasn't my generation. But yeah, I'm not someone that pretends to have been a Bob Dylan fan. But I can honestly say it's been, you know, since the early 80s. So that's certainly a long time. But it's not from the beginning. And so I hope that this movie, which is doing very well at the box office, it's got 8 Academy Award nominations, which is why I'm bringing this up with the Academy Awards coming up, is that here is a film that probably on its face was a little controversial in terms of, oh, here's another Bob Dylan film, and is Bob Dylan really mass appeal enough. Yes, he's known, but most people think of him as a bad singer, and they maybe know one or two songs. And what this movie does is really, I think, make you appreciate Bob Dylan's talent, appreciate how he became a change agent, how he was there at the time and rose to the occasion, how brave he was, how dedicated he was to his art, how uncompromising he was, how ambitious he was, and how important he was for that time. And then if you see what's happened in the 60 years since then, you say, wow, he hasn't stopped. He's certainly, like every artist that's had a long career, including Sinatra and anyone else, he's had ups and downs and valleys and hill and peaks and valleys. But here he is in now his early 80s, and he's still touring and he's still making albums. And so I think what's interesting that the filmmakers of Complete Unknown not only got the story right, there's so much about this film that they just other filmmakers didn't get. This one got it. They put all the aspects together. And I have to say that the most important part of it, much to my surprise, was the casting. It was controversial when we first heard it, when many people heard it, and yet it turned out to be a masterstroke. Timothée Chalamet, in my view, deserves to win the Oscar for this. And we'll see if he does or not. I don't know. But being a Bob Dylan aficionado, I was watching this film. There were times when I forgot it was Timothée Chalamet. And I was impressed at how he had his mannerisms down, his facial mannerisms and his gesturing and his walk and his voice tone and his cadence and his stare. The guy did his homework, and he completely became Bob Dylan of that time. It's a masterful performance. And believe me, for someone who has been a fan of Bob Dylan's now for many, many years, who I've seen him perform many times live in concert, I've seen him, you know, on shows, I've seen documentaries and things like that at all stages of his career. And I have to say that Timothée Chalamet nails this. And there is a sense of energy and joy and revelation in this story. And all the acting. The film got 8 nominations. Best Picture, Best Director, Best Screenplay, Best Costumes, which definitely deserves. The three principals in the film, the actors. Chalamet is nominated, Ed Norton as Pete Seeger, and a newcomer, Monica Barbaro, as Joan Baez, all three of them nominated, deservedly so. And what's ironic is that here is somebody not like Freddie Mercury, for instance, a bigger-than-life kind of persona that the movie American Bohemian or Bohemian Rhapsody helped to elevate, or even Rocketman film. A huge, flamboyant, well-known entity like Elton John, which helped introduce him to elevate his standing and introduce him to a newer, younger audience, just as the Bohemian Rhapsody film has completely elevated and transformed Freddie Mercury into an iconic rock star. And in most recently, the Elvis film did the same thing. And this film is doing it for Bob Dylan. And to me, that is quite an achievement because Bob Dylan is so enigmatic. He is known by everyone, but not known by anyone. He is a complete unknown. It's the perfect title. And it's deliberate. And so for Bob Dylan to become a mainstream entertainment entity more than 60 years later is quite an achievement. And for those of us who are Bob Dylan fans, it's so great to see that. The film has done great at the box office. It's obviously done well with the Academy Award nominations, and even more so from my standpoint, being a music fan, what I am most happy about is that this film is now garnering and drawing people in to discover Bob Dylan's music. And I have to give, once again, I have to give Timothy Chalamet huge, huge props for that happening, because his performance is so layered and so authentic and so effective and so charismatic that it's drawing people in. It's convincing them. It's opening their eyes. It's opening their minds to, you know, I've never been a Bob Dylan fan, but wow, I don't know. I never really listened to the words that much, or I never really listened to the song that much, or I didn't know that about him. And suddenly, 60-some years later, this guy that at one time was known as the voice of a generation now has a voice in the new generation, thanks to this film, and I think really because of the performance of Timothy Chalamet, who certainly has a following within a certain audiences, within the public, young people. You know, I mean, he's been in Willy Wonka and Dune now. It's also Dune 2 and things like that. He's created quite a career for himself. But this film, he's done what I would have thought was impossible. To make Bob Dylan a deliberate, enigmatic figure who has, for the most part, shied away from mass appeal. He's gone out of his way not to be popular, not to be praised and put on a pedestal, not to be a pop star, but rather to be a storyteller in the American folk and American tradition. And yet, at the same time, that's exactly what he has been. He's been a major change agent and a major figure in mainstream culture and mainstream entertainment, as much as he may not want to be. He is a walking contradiction. Deliberate. And yet, by casting Timothy Chalamet, who is a very well-known, mass appeal kind of actor, and by giving this incredible performance, he's opening people's eyes, and he's getting people, young people especially, to seek out Bob Dylan's music. So much so that when recently Timothy Chalamet was on Saturday Night Live, he was both the host and the musical guest, and he performed kind of in a Bob Dylan-esque way, like he did in the film, some obscure Bob Dylan songs. He didn't play Blowin' in the Wind or Like a Rolling Stone. He did three or four songs, and they were deliberately, just like Bob Dylan, deep cuts, rarities, songs that even people that may have thought they were Bob Dylan fans had never heard of. Real rarities. But clearly, Timothy Chalamet dug deep into the Bob Dylan ethos, into the Bob Dylan's life, into his musical catalog. The guy knows his stuff when it comes to Bob Dylan, clearly. And he sang one song that was not ever really even released as a single, for certainly. Was a very obscure song, and because of the way of he performed it on Saturday Night Live and a huge, you know, major, you know, exposure. And sang it because he's so popular. The song itself, well, though not known at all, suddenly entered the charts and got millions of views. The song is called Tomorrow is a Long Time. Dylan wrote this song in the early 60s. He never recorded it. A live version appeared on his Greatest Hits Volume 2 album from the early 70s, from 1971. And in fact, Elvis did a version of it, of which Bob Dylan says that's the greatest moment in his life, that the fact that Elvis Presley recorded one of his songs. But here's a song that nobody ever knew, not Blowing in the Wind, not some of the ones that you know, but this song called Tomorrow is a Long Time. And he performed it on Saturday Night Live, and because of the audience who watches it, because the fans of Timothy Chalamet, the song got millions of views. And on the power of the film and the music and the era that it focuses on, and some of the songs that it focuses on, especially Bob Dylan's second album, The Freewheelin' Bob Dylan, which has that classic picture of him and his girlfriend at the time, Susie Rotolo. The album, which was put out in like 1962, is now on the charts again. It debuted on the charts in like number 28. Now that means that people are buying this and people are seeking it out, and probably young people as well as some of the older people will said, "Oh, I'm not really a big fan of Bob Dylan." Well, suddenly their eyes have been opened by this. So I have to tell you, I think it's a great movie. If you're a Dylan fan, I think you will be impressed. If you haven't seen it yet, you should see it. If you're not a Bob Dylan fan, I think you should see it, because I think you're going to learn something. You're going to get a new appreciation for him. And I guarantee you, you're going to go online and look up some of these albums, some of these songs. And maybe you're going to even want to discover more of his catalog and background. You know, that's the way a lot of times we discover things. We are handed it or shown it from other people or other sources. So in this case, hey, yeah, Bob Dylan's been around for 60 years. There would be a view that you should know who Bob Dylan is, and you should know his music by now, right? Well, no, there's some people just growing up that they don't have any exposure to Bob Dylan. They weren't there during his heyday. He's an 83-year-old guy. What 15-year-old cares about what some 83 or 82-year-old guy's doing? But when presented in a way that appeals to a younger person, suddenly that 82-year-old person becomes much more relevant and much more interesting. That I want to figure it out. For instance, from my standpoint, hey, I love music. I was alive. I was listening and buying records in the 70s when Bob Dylan was around. I remember at least hearing or seeing the album like Blood on the Tracks or Desire and things like that. I never bought it. I was too young. I didn't get it. I didn't understand it. But I remember seeing his name and knowing that he was important in some way and hearing some songs. And certainly like a Rolling Stone and things like that. And slow, as the more I got involved in liked music, I started to discover older artists because of the artists that I liked. Like, for instance, Elton John introduced me to Little Richard and Jerry Lee Lewis and Fats Domino. Because those were, and even in some ways Elvis Presley, because those were his influences. I enjoyed Elton, as I did more research on him, I saw who influenced him. So I said, well, let me listen to this. And that's how I discovered that. And then when I looked up and just started to do a little research and decided, like, got into Little Richard, then I saw what influenced Little Richard or what influenced Elvis or Jerry Lee Lewis. And then I'm going back another generation. And that's how you begin to understand history. And you understand, but a lot of times it comes not because of some, ordained knowledge. It's from what initially appeals to you, and then you start to get inquisitive, and you start to look and say, well, what influenced that person? So like Bob Dylan, like I said, hey, Bob Dylan was a known entity by the time I was in my late teens and 20s. I was a huge music fan by the age of six or seven or eight. I didn't fully understand what Bob Dylan's music was. I didn't come to Bob Dylan around, as I said, till the early 80s, about 83. And the reason I did, for the most part, two things. You say, well, why did you become such a big Bob Dylan fan? I'll explain exactly why, which will show exactly what I'm talking about, is how we're influenced and what brings us in to expose us to things we might not already have been exposed to. And then it's up to us to do the work, to do the research, to go back if we're moved enough by it. But two things got me into Bob Dylan. Two things you would never expect. It wasn't some hippie culture ethos or anything else. It was two things. One was, I was and still am a huge fan of Dire Straits. The band Dire Straits. They came on the scene in the late 70s with Sultans of Swing. I love that song, and I have followed their career since then. And as well as Mark Knopfler's, the lead singer and the lead guitarist and the lead influence of Dire Straits. And so in 1983, I saw that Bob Dylan was putting out a new album. I didn't care about that. Bob Dylan, that was 60s stuff. This is the 80s, man. This is the cool, hip 80s. But I saw that Mark Knopfler produced this new album by Bob Dylan called Infidels. And because I liked Mark Knopfler is why I decided to give and look into this new Bob Dylan album. It got on my radar screen. It probably would never have been on my radar screen. Because in 1983, you had the British New Wave exploding on MTV. So why would I listen to Bob Dylan, who at that time, because at that time, a 40-year-old was considered old. But it was Mark Knopfler's influence. I was a big fan of Mark Knopfler's. So let's see. He's producing Bob Dylan. Maybe he'll play on it. Maybe he'll, I don't know, but I'm intrigued. Suddenly, this album, Infidels, is on my radar screen. And then, even more importantly, talk about the power of MTV. I didn't have MTV at the time. Lived in Chicago proper, and cable really didn't come to into Chicago until 1984 or so. Or even 85. It was all this political BS as usual. There's a lot of money to be made. But there were a few local shows that used to play videos because it was growing. It was a growing phenomenon. Even though it wasn't in Chicago, it was growing around the country. You were hearing about MTV. We couldn't get MTV. We could get it in the suburbs, so there was a recognition of it. If you had friends in the suburbs, you can go there and watch MTV. But if you lived in the city, you couldn't get it. That's the kind of world we live in, folks. Believe me. I know it sounds like the old West, but that's the way it was. And it wasn't that long ago. But there were a few local shows that played videos to capitalize on this new upcoming trend in the music world. the music video to accompany a new song or a new album or a new single. And I was watching one of these shows from a local television that would play daily videos because that was my only way to see it. It was on free TV. And there weren't a lot of videos yet. There was still an emerging, you know, genre. There wasn't, it still wasn't, you know, MTV, even though it started in 1981, it didn't immediately explode. You know, it wasn't until 82, and then when Thriller happened in 83, when the thing really just, you know, exploded, you know, and but it was coming along. And so there was a video made for a song from the new Bob Dylan album in 1983, from this album called Infidels. And the song was called Sweetheart Like You. And I saw Bob Dylan. And I watched it out of my curiosity, because I wasn't hearing it on the radio. That's for sure. Who was going to play a Bob Dylan song? Right? But here was this music video of this song called Sweetheart Like You from the Infidels album in 1983. And I fell in love with this song. And Bob Dylan looked so cool. And this was this quiet, simple, quirky little love song with some great lyrics, naturally. And I said, wow, that song is great. Mark Knopfler, so that's the album that I was reading about with Mark Knopfler. I bought that album. It is still one of my favorite Bob Dylan albums. And it got me into Bob Dylan. And on the strength of the popularity of that kind of comeback album of that song, of that album, then a whole big box set came out called Biograph that spanned Bob Dylan's career. And then I bought that, and then I was off to the races. But I got into Bob Dylan in 1983 thanks to Mark Knopfler and music video. So this is my point. Today, young people are getting into Bob Dylan, who they might not even know, because of two things. Probably first, Timothy Chalamet being in the movie, and B, that being enough to drive them to go see the film. And then being interested enough in the character of Bob Dylan and hearing this music, which is almost every scene, and going and exploring it, and then seeing him on Saturday Night Live and playing this obscure song, Tomorrow is a Long Road. And maybe people are now just saying, wait a minute, let me get into Bob Dylan. Let me discover Bob Dylan for the first time, even though he's been here for 60 years. And I think you're seeing now that many of the older legacy rock bands have realized that movies are going to be the key to their legacy. The music has been there. The music has been there for 40, 50, 60 years. But young people are drawn to their music for the most part, their peer group. There's a few that are little rebels that, you know, they adopt the music of their parents, or they go off on their own and they find alternative musics. But for the most part, if you saw the Grammys, you know, a certain demographic, a certain age group is all clued in to the same music, and it's of today. But sometimes these outside influences can have a huge impact on exposing and introducing younger people to older people. We've seen it now happen now We are a visual society today. There's no question. Yes, the audio and the music of these artists has been there. It can be discovered every minute of every day. But there has to be an impetus. There has to be a catalyst for the people to want to do it. And clearly in the visual world we are in, it is movies. And it's not just documentaries about that artist. I really believe it's about the newness and about the actors that are cast in it that also bring people to it. In this case, Timothée Chalamet, who's got a big following with young people and especially young women and young girls who drive our culture, as I've said many, many times. That's who's viewing things in the millions. That's who's downloading things in the millions. It's not people in their 30s. It's not people in their 60s. It's teenagers, mostly teenage girls. More power to them. They're driving the culture. Good for them. They have the means and they're taking the power. But so I think not only is Hollywood seeing these films as potential big money projects in an era where it's harder and harder to predict and what the public will like and it's harder to just to create a hit movie and get people into theaters anymore. But the rock stars themselves, their management, are realizing that the movies can be that entree. It's not YouTube. It's not Spotify. It's not your older brother. It's not your father or mother. The catalyst that's going to bring in young people, it seems right now, are biopics, are movies that are, but they have to be well done. There have been many movies about rock stars in the recent years that have failed. Several David Bowie films have failed. He's a perfect character and topic for a biopic, but they haven't gotten them right yet. We've been waiting for biopics on Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin. But certainly over the last several years, with the popularity of Bohemian Rhapsody, which has done amazing transformational work on the legacy of Freddie Mercury. He was pretty much unknown by the masses at this point. And now he's consistently viewed as one of the greatest rock stars of all time. He was certainly one of the best rock stars of his era, but he was not looked at as this legend that he is now. And it's because of that movie. It's because of the exposure of him and the music and his life. And to some extent, the Rocketman film with Elton John did the same thing. Introduced his story and his music to a new generation. Yes, people heard, younger people heard, one or two songs, but not in this way. That's why, coming up in the docket, you're going to see more and more. There's a Bruce Springsteen movie coming out. Just finished filming. It's supposed to come out sometime this year. Why is that happening? Because, yes, Bruce Springsteen has been around since the 70s. Yes. Hugely popular. One of the biggest stars ever. His music is there. He's tours. But if you go to his tour, there's more gray hairs than there are teenagers overall. So this film called Deliver Me From Nowhere talks about, once again, just like Complete Unknown, a very specific time in his career, actually a very unknown time. I'm sure it'll give some biographical things about his upbringing, but it's going to talk about what went into him recording an album that is critically acclaimed, but not his big seller, called Nebraska, a very spare, sparse, folk, almost folk album. Basically demos, not even polished in the studio, just him and his guitar for the most part. that came out between The River and Born in the USA when he became a huge star. So this very short little period of his time, but a very unreported time. But I'm sure that when that film comes out, because it's going to be starring, once again, smart casting, Jeremy Allen White from The Bear. The guy's been winning Emmy Awards ever since he started doing the show. Young people and older people are going to be drawn to that film because it's about Bruce Springs, but also because of Jeremy Allen White. They're going to learn about Nebraska and the making of it and the history of it. Now, those of us who are Springsteen fans, we know most of it. But the majority of the masses don't. So they're not only going to learn about Bruce Springsteen, they're going to learn about this specific time in his life, but then they're also going to most likely be introduced to him in a larger sense, and I'm certain that his popularity is going to rise after this film, if it's made well. We'll see. And I think there's going to start shooting sometime soon, within the next couple of years. Four individual movies on each Beatle are going to come out, directed by Sam Mendes, who did American Beauty and some other great films. Won the Academy Award for American Beauty. There's going to be individual film on John Lennon's life, on Paul McCartney's life, on Ringo Starr's life, and George Harrison's life. As big as the Beatles are, they still need to reach that audience, to keep that legacy going. All these bands from the 60s and 70s are in a legacy-building mode. And it seems in a visual society, it is movies that will help create and define that legacy. The music is there, but the masses need a catalyst, and the young people need a catalyst to discover it, to be drawn to it. And it appears to be movies. So as I said, we've got a Springsteen movie coming up in sometime this year. Within the next couple of years, we're going to have four Beatles movies. And I guarantee you, based on the popularity and the success of this Bob Dylan film, which could have been a huge flop, could have been a disaster, turned out to be a great, great film with huge impact for Bob Dylan's own career. Bob Dylan, not only being on the charts, Bob Dylan was supposed to end his tour. He's been touring for 3 years. The guy's in his 80s. Supposed to be sort of the end. Is he finally done? Well, you know what? He's already announced tour dates throughout 2025 to build on this momentum that suddenly Bob Dylan is cool again. As I said, he's got a voice for a new generation. He's not the voice for a generation, but he's a voice for the new generation. So his legacy now has been elevated. His name has been elevated. And I guarantee you, with the success of Complete Unknown, that was the impetus to get that, you know, the popularity of films like I said, Bohemian Rhapsody and Rocket Man was the impetus to get the Bruce Springsteen film made and these Beatle films. But now this one, A Complete Unknown, taking Bob Dylan, who's deliberately shied away from mainstream exposure and success, and has made him a mainstream success and artist in today's culture, which is amazing. I guarantee you, within the next year, we're going to hear about a Rolling Stones film, about a film about The Who, a film about Jimi Hendrix. I bet you we get that Janis Joplin film, because the success of A Complete Unknown shows that this is the entree. If you could make Bob Dylan a pop star again, then that's the marketing tool you need. And yes, the Rolling Stones are still out on tour. They just won a Grammy for their last album, Hackney Diamonds. Yes, but if they want to be remembered, if they want that legacy to continue 50 years from now and 100 years from now, there's no guarantees. But I guarantee you're going to see a Rolling Stones film. And and The Who needs one too. The Who is one of my favorite bands. They're often, you know, there's the Beatles and the Stones, and then there's the Who, maybe the Kinks and things like that. We were seeing right now, there's a Led Zeppelin documentary out. There was an Elton John documentary out recently, which I spoke about here on the podcast. The medium now to expose and to be legacy building are movies. And so expect to see more and more of those. And from my standpoint, that's great. From a music fan who loves these legacy artists, who still listen to them on a, that's the music I listen to. To know that they are, that I was, I don't know, insightful enough to have picked at a young age some legends like Elton John and Bruce Springsteen, and even 40 years ago, Bob Dylan again. And people like that who have been my favorites. I want people to appreciate what I've been appreciating for the last 50 some years of my life. And movies are apparently that entree. We're a visual society, and that's where the younger people are going, and that's where you need to find them, and that's how they will find you. Who would have thought in 2025 that Bob Dylan, of all people, would be one of the biggest stars in the world? It ain't me, babe. And so ends another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNRadio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. And don't forget to tell your friends, tell your family, tell anyone who listens to a podcast that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and it should be theirs too. Your loyalty and devotion are much appreciated. Hope you enjoyed episode number 455. I'm Jim Tirano. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. You've been listening to Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. From the end of my mind to your ears. What's a sweetheart like you doing in a dump like this?